Cordell before. At first, we figured him to be a witness.
While you've run into Mr. Cordell before, you never arrested him, correct?
Correct.
And he's never before been suspected in a crime. Isn't that true?
Yes.
So what was the context for previously running into Mr. Cordell?
He was a hanger-on in the neighborhood. We'd do a bust, and sometimes he'd be on the scene.
Okay. And so you've never known him to be violent, have you?
Well, he was violent when he took out three men.
You don't have any proof that he shot anyone, do you, Inspector?
He had the murder weapon in his possession.
And did you test Mr. Cordell's hands or clothing for gunpowder residue that would show that he'd actually discharged that weapon?
No, we did not.
And that's because you knew you wouldn't find any gunpowder residue. Isn't that right, Inspector?
The interview was going well. We were involved in getting answers, and we were confident that we would turn up a witness to the shooting.
Yuki was sweating under her black suit, but she thought she was giving Stan Whitney better than she was taking. She stood at a distance from the witness stand and asked,
"The fact is, you didn't turn up any witnesses to the shooting of those three men, did you?"
"No."
"And Mr. Cordell maintained for more than 15 straight hours that he didn't shoot anyone, didn't he?"
"I suppose, yes."
"But you didn't accept that."
"It seemed clear to me that he did it."
"It's not clear to me, Inspector. You didn't have a witness. You didn't have a gunshot residue test. You had no forensic evidence, and for almost 16 hours, you didn't have a confession either. Isn't that right?"
"Right."
Yuki said, "One of the functions of a police officer is to elicit an incriminating response. Isn't that right, Inspector Whitney? Yes or no?"
"Yes."
"And isn't it true that a teenager, especially one with mental challenges, would try to please the authority in the room who told him he could go home? Isn't that exactly what you told him, Inspector? Isn't that how you obtained Mr. Cordell's false confession?"
Parisi stood up and said, "Objection. Which of those questions does Miss Castellano want the witness to answer?"
"I withdraw the questions, Your Honor."
There was a low rumble in the room, people in the gallery whispering to their neighbors. The jury looked at the judge. Judge Quirk said, "Do you want to cross-examine the witness, Mr. Parisi?" Chapter 71. Len Parisi, DA of San Francisco and co-counsel with Morehouse and Rogers, who were paid to defend the city against lawsuits, got up from his seat and walked across the well to the witness, Inspector Stan Whitney.
"Inspector Whitney," Parisi said, "did you believe you had grounds to arrest Aaron Ray Cordell for shooting the three drug dealers?"
"Absolutely."
"Did you believe Mr. Cordell killed three men?"
"He's innocent until proven guilty, but he was our number one suspect, and I believed he did shoot them. He not only named the dead men, but he was carrying a weapon when he was arrested, fleeing from the scene of the crime."
"Did you hit Mr. Cordell in order to get him to confess?"
"No, I did not."
"Did you physically intimidate him?"
"No."
"Did you read him his rights?"
"Yes."
"Then why did you get him to sign a waiver of his right to an attorney?"
"Because we just wanted to make it absolutely clear that we gave him every opportunity to have an attorney, and he decided he didn't want a lawyer.
His decision. And what about access to his parents?"
"There was a note on the arresting officer's report not to call the parents."
"Do you know why?"
Parisi asked. "He told the arresting officers he was 18. It's common for kids not to want their parents to know whatever it is they've done."
"Did you know Aaron Ray's age?"
"No. He had no priors and no ID." Parisi turned so that he was facing the jurors and asked,
"Why do you think this was a properly obtained confession, Inspector Whitney?"
Whitney said, "Because we used the tools at our disposal.
We wanted a confession, yes, but we didn't do anything outside the law. Mr. Cordell said he killed those three scumbags, and in my opinion, that was the truth." "Thank you, Inspector. I have nothing else for this witness," said Parisi.
There was some shifting in seats and some murmured conversation as Parisi returned to the defense table. The judge said,
Quiet.
He banged his gavel, and when the room settled down, he said,
Redirect, Miss Castellano?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yuki stepped out from behind the table, passing Parisi without looking at him on the way to the witness box. She faced Whitney square on and said,
Inspector Whitney, will you agree that before Aaron Ray said he shot those scumbags, he said he didn't shoot anyone?
Like everyone else we ever had in the box.
Please answer the question. In fact, Mr. Cordell said he didn't shoot anyone. Isn't that correct?
Whitney said,
Yes, that's true.
And would it surprise you to know that during the course of your interrogation of him, Mr. Cordell said he didn't shoot anyone on 67 different occasions?
I didn't know that.
Well, we counted.
Okay.
And would it also surprise you to know that during the course of your interrogation, he denied owning the gun on 22 different occasions?
Again, I wasn't counting.
Again, Inspector, we counted. So adding this up, on 67 different occasions, Mr. Cordell denied shooting the gun, and on 22 different occasions, he denied owning the gun. And Inspector Whitney, how many times did he say he shot these three drug dealers?
Once, I guess.
Once. And that was after more than 15 hours in the box, wasn't it?
Yes, Whitney said, showing no emotion at all.
And you had no witness or evidence to impeach this boy's statement, did you?
No.
And so you wore this boy down until he finally said, I did it. Isn't that right?
Yuki asked. Whitney just looked at her. Yuki said,
You can't answer, can you?
She let her question hang in the air, then said,
Nothing further, Your Honor. I have no more questions for this witness.
Chapter 72. Natalie Futterman pushed her tablet toward Yuki so that she could read the word awesome in giant letters. Yuki smiled, then got to her feet and called Inspector William Brand. Brand came in through the swinging doors at the back of the room, walked across the hardwood floor, and pushed through the bar to the witness stand. He put his hand on the Bible, said his name and that he agreed to tell the truth, then sat in the chair in the witness box. Yuki approached him, seeing the anger coming off his square face, the tension in his muscular form, his collar denting the flesh around his neck. She got right to it.
Mr. Brand, were you familiar with Aaron Ray Cordell before he was your suspect in the murders of three drug dealers?
Yes.
How did you know him?
I've seen him in that crack house at Turk and Dodge when we made busts there a couple of times.
Yuki asked,
And did you ever search him for drugs or weapons?
Yes.
How many times?
Twice, I think.
And you never found drugs or weapons on his person, isn't that right?
That's right.
Was he belligerent?
No.
How would you characterize his personality?
He was a big dumb kid in a crack house. I didn't give him a personality evaluation, and I didn't think about him too much.
He had no criminal record prior to his arrest for carrying a weapon, isn't that right?
Correct.
Was he belligerent when you interrogated him in conjunction with the shootings on February 16th of this year?
Not really.
Could you describe his demeanor in a few words?
Brand sighed, shrugged, and then said,
He cried. He denied having anything to do with the crimes.
Yuki said,
So just to make sure I understand this, you'd seen Mr. Cordell before. You didn't know him to be a drug user or to carry a weapon, and he had no prior record. Isn't that right?
Right.
But in this instance, you pushed him to confess to a crime that he denied committing. Isn't that true?
He had the smoking gun, miss. Those guys were shot in the chest at close range. Only a dummy could get close enough with a gun to kill A. Biggie and his crew. Understand what I'm saying? They weren't afraid of the shooter, of A. Ray. Anyone else, they would have defended themselves.
Brand had just told Yuki something she hadn't heard before. If he had made a mistake, she might be able to capitalize on it and destroy his credibility. On the other hand, she could be about to make a big mistake of her own. Chapter 73. The first rule of cross-examination was never to ask a witness a question if you didn't know the answer. Sometimes, though, you had to gamble.
Inspector Brand, you just stated that Aaron Ray Cordell, a dummy, was the only person who could have gotten close enough to the drug dealers to shoot them at close range. Isn't that right?
That's right.
But you didn't know that the shots that killed those three men were fired at close range, did you?
I don't understand the question.
I'll rephrase it. Mr. Cordell was arrested for carrying a gun at around noon on February 16th. He was brought to your station, and almost immediately thereafter, you interrogated him until the morning of the 17th. When did you see the bodies of the dead drug dealers?
Couple days after, said Brand.
Couple of days after you interrogated Mr. Cordell?
That's right.
So just to make sure I understand, when you saw their bodies, they were in the morgue. Isn't that right?
Brand looked confused. Like he was double-thinking what he'd said, trying to follow her, maybe realizing his mistake.
Right.
And so, to be clear, your testimony a few moments ago was untrue, wasn't it? You only saw the bodies several days after you'd extracted a confession from Mr. Cordell, correct?
I got mixed up about the times, that's all.
So you didn't know how close or how far away the shooter was to the victims when you interrogated Mr. Cordell, right?
I said I got my timeline wrong.
Yuki pushed on.
And so, as I understand it, you were interrogating a dummy without representation, and you decided to make a case against him without a witness, without forensic evidence, without even a theory. You came up with that later. But first, you sweated this poor kid until you finally got a confession, which is all you wanted. Isn't that right, Inspector Brand?
That's your way of putting it, said Brand.
Yes, it is,
said Yuki.
I have no other questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Parisi,
the judge asked,
do you want to cross-examine this witness?
Parisi spoke from his seat behind the defense table. He looked unfazed, like a man with all the right answers.
Inspector Brand, did you have friendships with or loyalty to the drug dealers who were killed?
What?
No. Did you have anything against Mr. Cordell? No, not at all. So regarding your vigorous interrogation of Mr. Cordell, that's what you do when you have a primary suspect. Isn't that right?
Correct.
Do you stand by the confession you obtained from this suspect?
Absolutely, said Brand.
He said he did it. We saw him say it. We believed him.
Parisi said,
thank you, Inspector Brand. I have nothing else for this witness.
If Ms. Castellano has no further questions, said the judge, the witness may stand down.
Chapter 74. Court had been adjourned for the day when Yuki got a text from Brady saying, Tony Willis was beaten. He's in the prison ward at SF Gen. Asked for you. Yuki ran to her car, got into the crush of traffic, and headed towards San Francisco General, where inmates requiring hospitalization were housed. Tony Willis, a.k.a. Lil Tony, had been a suspect in the jailhouse murder of Aaron Ray Cordell. He'd denied that he'd been the doer, but when she'd talked to him last, he'd given her a sense that he knew who had killed Aaron Ray. Maybe he would tell her now, if he lived. The traffic was thick, and Yuki was determined not to have an accident or even a fit of temper. Leaving the parking garage, she took a left on Polk and crossed through the Mission. It took close to half an hour to drive 2.5 miles to reach 23rd Street and another 20 minutes to park the car and gain access to the hospital. When she arrived at Ward 7D, the surgical unit, Tony Willis was alive and breathing oxygen through a cannula. Leads came off his chest, and fluids were dripping through tubes to his veins. The doctor told Yuki,
that young man lost a lot of blood. He has several puncture wounds in major organs. He's on pain medication. I can't promise he'll know who you are.
He asked for me.
I understand. Keep it to 5 minutes, okay?
Yuki walked down the aisle, running the length of the ward. All of the 11 beds were occupied. Willis was at the far end on the left.
She reached the bed, pulled the stall curtain around it, and moved a chair up to the bed. 5-foot-tall Tony Willis had looked young before. Now he looked smaller and younger, with his defiant little hair twists and his thin cotton blanket pulled up to his underarms, monitors reporting on his vital signs.
Tony? It's me, Miss Castellano.
Tony Willis cracked open his eyes, winced, and put a bandaged hand on his blanketed chest.
Yo, he said. You came.
How are you feeling?
Like a lot of white dudes beat the crap out of me and then stuck me with shanks everywhere.
That's what I heard. You stay strong, okay?
Right,
he said.
I have something to say.
Okay.
I need you to be my lawyer so I got confidentiality.
You want me to represent you, Tony? There's more to it than that. I have to look at your case. I don't know what charges there are against you. And it's not my decision. I don't work for myself.
Mrs. Cassiolandro, you got to listen. I need lawyer-patient confidentiality right now. You hear me?
He was wheezing. He was clearly in pain. He could die.
Okay. Okay, Tony, I'll be your lawyer. What do you have to tell me?
Officially?
She picked up his bandaged hand and shook it gently.
It's official, she said.
Okay. I got a confession. I killed A-Ray.
Yuki gasped.
You killed him?
I was told, put Cordell down quick. After that, I was supposed to get a transfer to Corcoran, and you can see that didn't happen.
I'm not getting this,
Yuki said. She was trying to get it, but the pieces had very weird shapes and didn't totally fit. Whoever got Lil Tony to kill Aaron Ray had also promised him protection. Who the hell would do that? Furthermore, as he said, they clearly hadn't delivered it.
Who told you to do this, Tony?
Yuki asked him.
Listen to me, lady, before I fucking die. It was a cop who told me to whack A-Ray.
What cop? Give me a name.
On the street, he called one. Like, numero uno.
Tony, that's not a name. What else can you give me? I can't make a deal for you if all you've got to bargain with is that you killed Aaron Ray. No one is looking for his killer anymore.
Tony was straining to breathe. Any second now, a nurse was going to chase her out. She touched his hand.
You've got to give me something I can run with, Tony. You understand, numero uno isn't going to cut it.
You don't look it, but you are a tough lady.
He swallowed hard. Then he said,
Arturo Mendez. Find him. He's A-Ray's friend. He saw who shot those pushers.
How do I find him?
Tony closed his eyes. His breathing was ragged.
Fuck,
he said.
I got to do everything? Ask A-Ray's mom.
Hang in,
Yuki said.
I'll do what I can.
Chapter 75. Yuki called Aaron Ray's mother, B. Cordell, who had her son's phone, which showed a contact listing for Arturo. Yuki sent Arturo a text, replied to his response, then sent another. An hour later at nearly 8 p.m., she parked on Turk near Dodge, the bad news block directly across the street from the peeling 3-story crack house on the corner. She didn't have to wait long. A kid came out of the Chinese restaurant next door to the crack house. He looked about 5'8", 140. He was wearing jeans hanging below his hip bones, striped boxer shorts, and a dark hoodie, and had iPod cords dangling from his ears. He stood on the corner for a while, looking every which way, his eyes resting for a moment every time he swept his gaze across her bronze-colored Acura 2-door sedan. When the traffic thinned, The kid ambled across the street, nodding his head in time to music. Then he walked over to her window.
Yuki?
Arturo, get in the car, she said.
Yuki thought if Brady could see her inviting a crack dealer into her car, he would go bug nuts. Arturo got in and pulled the door closed, saying,
I got 1 minute.
Mrs. Cordell told you? I need to know what happened that day in the crack house.
And what'd I get?
A chance to do the right thing.
And a free lawyer if I ever need one?
Yes, free lawyer. Deal.
They shook on that. She fished a card out of her bag and handed it to Arturo. Christ, she'd tripled her client base today. Meanwhile, Arturo's eyes were working the streets from under his hood. The sidewalks were empty. He started talking.
Aaron didn't shoot no one. It was three men that did that. They looked like cops. They wore police jackets. They showed up on the second floor and everyone scattered, but I was coming out the bathroom and I saw it going down.
Yuki was startled. More than that, she was shocked.
The men who shot those dealers were cops?
I don't know if they were cops. They were wearing cop jackets. They had guns. They said SFPD. But they were wearing plastic masks. They pushed Dwayne, A. Biggie, and Double D up against the wall. They kicked their legs apart, patted them down. They took their money, their drugs, their guns, their phones, naked pictures of their girlfriends, for all I know. Then A. Biggie and his crew turns around, and A. Biggie says, you done? And one of them cops, seemed like the head dude, said, I'm sorry. Put yourself in my shoes. Something like that. And he just blew them away.
Arturo's expression drooped, like he was seeing it all over again. He shook his head like he couldn't stop the images.
Yuki said, Arturo, why haven't I heard this before?
Because I was the only living one that saw it go down. And then I see the three of them men go down the stairs like nothing happened.
Then what?
Yuki asked.
I wait a couple of minutes, make sure the coast is clear, and then I'm ready to run out, and A-Ray comes charging upstairs. He missed the shooting, and he's looking for his homies like always. They treat him okay. He doesn't see anything yet. He says to me, look at what I found on the stairs, Turo. He had a .38 in his hand that belonged to the shooter. And I say, A-Ray, get out of here, man. He sees the dead guys and he starts to go over to them. He loves them, man, and he's crying, and I just yell, let's go. And then we run down the stairs. Aaron Ray is first. And by the time I get to the street, he's running, and a patrol car sees that big boy, and they chase him in the car. Then they get out and throw him to the ground.
Arturo went on.
I see that, but what I'm supposed to do, huh? It was cops who shoot those boys. I just fade out of sight.
Yuki said, you know what happened to A-Ray in jail?
I heard, yeah. He thought everyone was his friend.
Arturo, could you ID those men in the police jackets?
Not really. Definitely not the head dude. One of the other two, maybe. He had a little tat on his neck. I might have seen a tat like that on a narc.
Yuki felt the adrenaline shoot straight through her, but she kept her expression as neutral as possible. She said,
I'm suing the city on behalf of A-Ray's family. I need you, Arturo. I need you to testify for Aaron Ray.
And then what? I'll be dead too.
Let me see what I can do, said Yuki.
Oh yeah, right, said Arturo.
He started to get out of the car, but Yuki reached over and gripped his forearm. She said,
I'm your lawyer. I've got pull. If I call you, take my call. It means I can get you whatever you need.
Arturo got out of the car and didn't look back. Yuki sat in the car and watched him cross the street the way he'd come. Then she did the unthinkable. She called her former boss and current opponent, Red Dog Parisi. When he answered, she said,
Len, it's Yuki. I've got two new witnesses who can turn this case upside down. We need to meet right away.
Chapter 76. On the way home from another fruitless day of interviewing the Calhoun family's friends and neighbors, I found myself thinking about Tina Strickler. Taking a chance, I phoned Mr. and Mrs. Nathan Goslin from the car. The Goslins had been on Balmy Alley when Dr. Tina Strickler had been knifed in the crosswalk, and Mrs. Goslin had actually seen the killer, although from behind and with several people between her and the man with the knife. Conklin had interviewed Nathan and Allison Goslin on the scene, and Inspectors Michaels and Wang, the two homicide cops in charge of the case, had also spoken to them that day. But because the Goslins had said they couldn't make an ID, they'd been written off. In fact, I was pretty sure the entire case had been shelved, now that every cop in the Hall of Justice was working some portion of the Windbreaker cop case. The Goslins sounded glad I'd called, and told me they hadn't thought about much other than the woman who'd been killed on the street since it had happened. Mr. Goslin gave me their address, which turned out to be a well-kept apartment building at Elizabeth and Diamond Streets. Mrs. Goslin buzzed me in, answered the door, and welcomed me into her home. "Thanks for making time for me," I said. "I just want to go over the events of that day one more time." After my brush with death at Wayne Broward's house, I was cautious when entering, keeping my eyes on Mrs. Goslin, walking practically sideways to the kitchen, where Mr. Goslin was sitting at the table with the remains of his chicken dinner. "No, please don't get up," I said.
"Have a seat," said Nathan Goslin. "What can I get you?"
"Nothing, thanks," I said. "I only need a few minutes of your time." I said that, but I hoped the few minutes would be full of newly recollected information that would give me a toehold on the case. I sat at the table and asked the basic questions. "What did you see? Are you sure you didn't see the killer's face? Can you think of any detail that may have seemed insignificant at the time?" Allison Goslin sighed. She said,
"I've thought about this night and day. You have to understand, not only did it happen fast, the street was jam-packed and people were trying to make the light, and I wasn't directly looking at the man who did that wretched thing."
"I understand."
"So, as I said at the time, I'm pretty sure he was white. He had brown hair, a black baseball-type jacket. He looked to be normal height. He never turned to face me. When Dr. Strickler dropped, most people panicked and ran. Me too. I just wanted to find Nate and call 911. So when I finally did look for that man, he was just gone."
I said, "Allison, you are obviously a very astute woman, the kind of person who notices small details. And frankly, that's the best kind of witness. Using your mind's eye to search for detail, is there anything else, no matter how small it might seem?" Allison Goslin said,
"I have had a thought and didn't say anything about it."
"Well, it's not too late," I said, scooching my chair closer to the table.
"Well, I saw a lot of threes that day."
"Threes?"
"Yes. There were three people between me and the man who killed Dr. Strickler. There were three squad cars that arrived first, and three policemen spoke with me. And I saw three blackbirds sitting on the telephone line."
I did my best not to explode with, "For God's sake!" I channeled my good-natured partner and said, "Allison," but she wasn't done.
"And there were three EMTs around her body. And the date itself, the 12th of May. 1 and 2 equals 3,
she concluded triumphantly.
"Okay," I said.
"So what does that mean to you?" Mrs. Goslin laughed.
"I don't know. You're the detective, aren't you, Sergeant?"
How much deader could a dead end be? I thanked the Goslins, left them my card, and left their apartment. I called Joe.
"I'm going back to work, Joe. Save me some leftovers."
"I know. I'm sorry. I swear I'll be home in 2 hours. I promise." Chapter 77. Tina Strickler's cruel death disturbed me above and beyond Joe's fixation on the possible sequential string of Claire's birthday murders. The Strickler case wasn't cold.
It was active, and I knew Michaels and Wang weren't working on it. It pissed me off, but I understood. They had no witnesses, no leads, and no time to dig into the case, which had fallen directly to the bottom of the list. But the case was very real and present to me. I'd seen Strickler's blood running into the street. I'd gone through her wallet and had seen that she'd had a psychiatric practice. She'd had a well-put-together appearance and very likely a full life, which had been terminated by a madman with a knife, an unknown killer who might never be known. After talking with Joe, I drove to the hall and took the elevator to the 6th floor jail, where I asked to see Wayne Broward. Broward was in jail because I'd breached his chain-link, barking dog, no trespassing and that means you security system, and I was going to be at his arraignment in the morning. However, he'd never answered my question. I pulled rank on the desk sergeant, applying a little pressure, and Wayne was taken from his cell past visiting hours and shown into an interview room. When he saw me, he called out, "Sweetheart, give me a kiss." Against the rules, Wayne. His guard sat him down in the chair and locked his handcuffs to a hook in the table. The guard knew why Broward was in lockup, and he asked me,
"Do you want me to hang in with you here, Sergeant?"
"Thanks, Santino, but I'll be okay." It was embarrassing to be reminded, but it was true. The man sitting across from me might have killed me. "Wayne, I have a question for you."
"Isn't my lawyer supposed to be here?"
"This has nothing to do with your case. You're being charged for assaulting me with a deadly weapon." He laughed.
"Assault? That's an overstatement, don't you think?"
I kept going. "I'm sure that's the position your lawyer will take tomorrow. Meanwhile, remember why I came to see you at your house?"
"Nope. Remind me."
I took Tina Strickler's picture out of my jacket pocket. It was creased, but still recognizable. "This woman. Have you ever seen her?"
"Not that I recall."
"Refresh my memory. Do you know her, Wayne? Have you ever seen her?"
"She looks familiar."
"Really?" I felt a little spark of hope.
"Wait," he said. "Didn't you show me her picture before?"
I nodded.
"Yep, I showed you the picture before."
Was Wayne Broward really this loony? Or was his crazy guy persona a well-honed act? I'd dealt with crazy killers before.
And actually, Wayne Broward wasn't as crazy as some of them.
I told Wayne I'd see him around and called the guard. I left the hall around 8:30 p.m. and made the drive home, the whole time trying to shake Dr. Tina Strickler out of my head and not managing it at all. Chapter 78. Joe was not in a good mood.
"You said you'd be home at 7, Lindsay."
"I'm sorry."
"Okay."
His face was stiff, like he'd been fuming for a while. Embracing him was like hugging a tree. "I'm sorry. Did something happen?"
"No,"
he said.
"Just your average single parent day. I cleaned up the kitchen, I vacuumed, I did the laundry, I put together a bag of stuff for Goodwill. Julie, Martha, and I went to Whole Foods. I peeled, chopped, parboiled, and roasted dinner. I bathed Julie, I put her to bed, I trimmed Martha's nails, and I ate dinner. Alone. I cleaned up the kitchen, I took out the garbage, I made the bed, I applied for 3 consulting jobs in D.C. Oh, I got a phone call from Evan Monroe, who was looking for you."
"Who is Evan Monroe?"
"He's Tina Strickler's brother."
Tina Strickler's brother had called me? Why? I put that news break on a back burner for the moment. I said to Joe, "Would you have been this mad at me if I'd been home at 7?
"I doubt it. You're taking advantage, Linz."
I did get it. While I was out doing my job all day, he was holding the home team together without benefit of stimulation or adult conversation. I got that he wasn't just steamed up about today. It was an accumulation of days like this, added to the fact that I was working a very dangerous job that might follow me home, if I even got home. I told Joe all of that, and I did my best to make amends. I said I would be more mindful of late hours and that I owed him a lot. And that tomorrow I would get Mrs. Rose to come in and that we could go out to dinner. Anywhere. I stopped short of groveling.
Okay, okay, forget it. So, where were you?
He asked. I went to see Wayne Broward.
In jail? How'd that go?
He's nuts. He needs to stay locked up. I hope he gets a shitty lawyer. Joe hadn't totally forgiven me, but he laughed. Then he took a plate of food out of the fridge. I got up and took it out of his hand. I can heat that up. You sit, I said. I put the plate of chicken and green beans in the microwave, and I poured wine for both of us. While my dinner revolved, I took off my shoes, put my gun away, and went in to see Julie, who was sleeping deeply. I heard the microwave beeping. Joe worked on his computer while I ate, which was okay. My mind was focused on the message from Evan Monroe, wondering if it was too late to call him back and if my returning that call would irritate my husband even more. I cleaned up the kitchen, and after a quick shower and a change of clothes, I said, Joe, what did Evan Monroe want? Joe said,
Wang gave him your name. I think because you were first officer. So Monroe's calling you because there hasn't been any movement on the case. He told me he had an idea about who could have killed Tina.
He told you that? I said.
He was messed up, Lindsay. I told him you'd call, but he wouldn't let me off the phone. He said that when Tina was in graduate school, she was raped. She identified the guy and he was put away for 25 years. She saw him when he was up for parole a while back, and she told Evan afterward that she was no longer sure he was the person who raped her.
Is the guy out?
Yep. His time was up 5 years ago, beginning of May.
Holy crap! Evan Monroe told you the guy's name?
Clement Hubble. I looked him up on VICAP.
Joe went to the living room and sat on the sofa. I sat next to him and he put his arm around me. That felt good.
Joe said, Hubble was let out on May 5th, 5 years ago. If Tina wrongly identified him, he's had a lot of time to make a plan. But it might have been hard to find her from lockup. She was Bettina Monroe when she was raped. She got married and divorced and kept her married name.
Let's see what Hubble looks like, I said, putting my hand on my husband's thigh. Joe leaned forward, opened his laptop, and called up Hubble's mugshot. He was white. His hair was brown. He was 5'10", which made him average height. And as of May 5th, 5 years ago, he was a free man. Chapter 79. It hadn't taken Joe long to locate Clement Hubble, the man who'd been convicted of rape, had done 20 years in Chino, and had been released 2 weeks before the first of what Joe saw as five linked murders, one a year on the 12th of May. After lunch with Julie and her sitter, and under a sunny sky, Joe drove toward Edge Hill Mountain and the home of Denise and Clement Hubble. Edge Hill Mountain was an old, remote development with winding roads and small, widely spaced houses that had views of the Pacific and Ocean Beach. His car's GPS told Joe that he was coming up on his destination, and then he saw it up ahead on his left. A tidy tan house with red doors, standing alone at the side of the road. Joe slowed the car to get a look at the picket-fenced vegetable garden beside the house, where an older woman in red checkered pants and a pink cardigan was weeding the beds. He checked the number on the mailbox, then pulled his Mercedes into the driveway next to a dinged-up Toyota wagon. He took his Glock out of the glove box and slipped it into his shoulder holster, then pulled on his leather bomber jacket and got out of the car. Putting his hands in his jacket pockets, Joe walked over to the gate and peered into the garden. The woman who was working the soil had sweet, doll-like features and white hair. She looked to be in her mid-70s, probably Hubble's mother.
Mrs. Hubble?
Joe said. The woman looked up, shielding her eyes from the sun.
Oh, hi, Jerry, she said. Where's Clem?
No, ma'am. My name is Joe Molinari. We've never met. You're Clem's mom?
Yes, I'm Denise, but Clem isn't home. I thought he was with you.
The woman laughed, got to her feet, and dusted off her knees.
Come on in, she said. I've got blueberry muffins in the oven and a jar I just cannot open by myself.
Joe said, sure. He opened the gate for Denise Hubble, who chattered away as she led him to the house about planting different types of peppers. Joe weighed whether or not to go into the house before deciding, what the hell? Clement Hubble wasn't home, and his mother might help him fill in some blanks. Joe followed Mrs. Hubble as she opened the back door, which led directly into the kitchen. She said, have a seat. Joe sat down at the red formica table, and Mrs. Hubble handed him the screw-top jar of sliced peaches, then fussed around the kitchen. Joe opened the jar and said, it's so beautiful out here, Denise. How's Clem doing?
Oh, still crazy after all these years, she laughed. He spends most of his time in the hole.
Denise Hubble used oven mitts to take the muffin pan out of the oven and put it down heavily on the stovetop. Joe saw immediately that the batter was still unbaked, but she didn't seem to realize it.
Let's let them cool for a minute, Jerry.
I'm sorry, Joe said. What do you mean, the hole?
Denise removed her mitts, fluffed her hair, and said,
that's what he calls his room. Any space too big or too bright makes him dizzy. To think how the two of you used to run around all the time to all hours. I had to bait Clem with dinner, and once he was in, bolt the door.
She laughed again. She had a very nice laugh.
You think he'd mind if I saw his room?
Joe said.
I've got a note for him that I'll leave on his dresser.
You go ahead, said Clement Hubble's mom. End of the hall, you know where it is. When you get back, we'll have coffee and sweets.
Joe said,
good deal,
and walked through the kitchen and into a hallway. He passed the living room on his right, then a pink floral-papered bedroom to the left. Beyond that was a door centered at the end of the hallway. Joe turned the knob, expecting to see Clem Hubble's hole, but rather than a bedroom at the back of the house, there was a flight of stairs heading down. Joe found a light switch and flicked it on. He saw that the wooden stairs led to a basement room, which was another way of saying the hole. Joe left the hallway door open and started down. Chapter 80. When he reached the bottom of the stairs, Joe saw that the basement was a typical subterranean cinder block room. It had a washer, a dryer, a water heater, a furnace, stacks of boxes, and a pile of lawn furniture. Four small, high windows let in some light. There was no bed or sofa or anything that suggested a living space. But under the staircase was a narrow door with a gleaming brass doorknob that suggested use and might be the entrance to Clement Hubble's hole. Joe considered again what he was doing and was sure he was not breaking any laws. He'd been invited into the house, had gotten permission to go to Hubble's room. He turned the knob and the door opened, letting him into another hallway, this one totally devoid of light. He left the door open behind him, and after letting his eyes acclimate, he noticed that the floor of this hallway was made of poured concrete and that it was on a 15-degree downward angle. Calculating the turns he'd made, he was heading under the vegetable garden, but about 20 feet down. He cupped his hands and called out, "Hello!" Not hearing an answer or any sound, he kept one hand on the cinder block wall and walked down the incline until it terminated in an empty 12-by-12 room that was dimly lit by a pale blue light. Centered in the floor of that room was a hatch door flipped back into the open position. There was an attic-type folding ladder attached to the hatch frame by a spring-loaded hinge, and the ladder extended straight down into a pale pool of bluish light. Joe called, "Hello!" again, and as before, there was no answer. He had too much curiosity to walk away, but climbing down that ladder was a big commitment to the unknown. He would need both his hands on the ladder, meaning his gun would be holstered, and he would be backing down virtually blind into whatever lay below. Although Hubble wasn't home, Joe still had a queasy feeling that this hole could be a bear trap. He put his hands on his knees and peered down into the opening. He looked down from another side of the hole and saw nothing but the long length of ladder and the dim blue light. He decided to retrace his steps and tell Denise Hubble of the unbaked muffins that he'd visit again some other time. But instead, he found himself getting a grip on the ladder, making sure it was steady, placing one foot on the top rung. And after that step proved to be stable, Joe began the descent to the bottom of the ladder. When both of his feet were on solid concrete, Joe found the source of the light, a couple of open laptops on a roughly made desk. He was moving toward the desk, hoping to find a lamp, when a muscular arm snaked across his chest from behind and a sharp, cold blade stung the tight skin of his throat.
"Who the hell are you?"
said the man with the knife. Chapter 81. Joe froze. He considered kicking back at the man's knees, but since that action could get his throat cut, he held up his hands and said,
"Nothing to be concerned about, Clement. You certainly don't need the knife, man. Your mom asked me to come down and check on you, that's all. She was worried. Didn't you hear me calling you?"
Joe had kept his voice steady, but he couldn't control either his heart's sudden drumbeat or the sweat beating his upper lip. The arm around his chest loosened slightly, but the knife tightened. Joe felt it cut into his skin. At the same time, he felt the man's hand lift the gun from his shoulder holster.
"Nice piece," said the man's voice. "Government grade. What are you, FBI? "I work for the feds," Joe said. "I'm a civilian now, retired."
"So what are you doing here?"
Joe said,
"I drive this road sometimes, and when I see your mom in the garden, I talk to her. She gave me some chives one time."
Joe was making it up as he went along, but he sounded convincing to his own ears. At the same time, adrenaline was coursing through his veins, like a river over its banks in the rainy season. He forced himself to slow his breathing and focused on his surroundings. The room was about 12 by 8 feet, the dimensions of a roomy two-person jail cell. There was a metal-framed bunk bed against one of the long sides of the room. On the short side to his right was that desk made of a couple of 10-inch boards resting on two cinder block pedestals. To his left, on the other short wall, were a toilet, a washstand with no mirror, and a 4-cubic-foot refrigerator. Joe had no sense of what was behind him on the opposite long wall.
"Have a seat, G-Man," said the ex-con who lived in the hole.
He moved the knife away and shoved Joe against the lower berth of the bunk bed, which moved a couple of inches back toward the wall when he struck it. Joe righted himself and got his first good look at Clement Hubble. Hubble was lanky, leaner than when his mugshot had been taken. His hair was close-shaven. He wore a wife beater and a pair of cotton pants. He was barefoot. His arms were tattooed from fingers to collarbones in prison art. Skulls, snakes, naked women, the word mom inside a heart on his right biceps. The heart pulsed when Hubble flexed his arm. Joe watched as Hubble set the knife down within reach on the desk and checked to see if Joe's gun was loaded. It was. He pointed it at Joe and at the same time lifted the ladder, which was weighted so that it easily rose up to rest parallel to the ceiling. As the ladder rose, the ceiling hatch closed. Joe's hammering heart picked up its tempo. He was 20 years older than Hubble. With the ladder up and the hatch closed, there was no way out. Hubble pointed to a pair of handcuffs beside Joe's feet, and Joe saw that the cuffs were linked to a length of chain that ran under the bed. The other end of the chain was likely looped around the bed leg closest to the wall.
"Cuff yourself," Hubble said. "Then we can talk." "This is unnecessary," Joe said. "I have nothing against you, Clem."
Hubble pointed the gun at the wall next to where Joe sat and fired it. The sound was loud, and it reverberated for long seconds. Hubble said,
"Next shot's for you."
Joe picked up the cuffs and clasped one, then the other, around his wrists. He moved the chain to get a sense of how long it was. About 5 feet. He could get to the toilet, but it was too short for him to reach Hubble, who sat facing him in a swivel chair.
What's your name?
A relaxed Clement Hubble asked Joe.
Joe.
Joe what?
Hogan.
Okay, Joe Hogan. Get comfortable. I feel like I've been waiting to meet you for a very long time.
Chapter 82. The door to Leonard Parisi's office was closed when Yuki arrived for the meeting. She checked the time, confirming that she was 6 minutes late. She explained to Parisi's assistant that she'd been stopped at the security desk downstairs. But before Darlene could speak, Parisi opened his door.
I thought I heard your voice, he said. We're waiting.
Parisi's office took up a big corner section of the second floor. It was huge for offices in the hall, but whatever it gained in size, it lost in its proximity to the sounds of the heavy traffic on Bryant Street. Chief of Detectives Warren Jacoby was at the round oak conference table with his back to the windows. Parisi, Yuki's former boss and mentor, took the seat closest to his desk, and Yuki sat between the two men, not far from the door. Darlene passed bottled water around, and Parisi asked her to hold his calls, then said to Yuki,
You're on first.
Yuki took a pull from her water bottle. After 5 years of being Parisi's protege, she felt that the table had turned 180 degrees. This was her meeting, and she hoped she could pull it off.
I've got a meeting with the mayor in 15 minutes, Jacoby said.
Yuki said,
I'll get right to the point. I met with two new witnesses yesterday. They are reluctantly willing to cooperate if they get protection. If they tell what they know, we'll have a strong lead on the identities of the parties who killed the dope dealers on Turk and Dodge. We'll also know who killed Aaron Ray Cordell.
Parisi said,
This is what subpoenas are for, Counselor. Let's hear their testimonies.
Only with protection, Len. Both witnesses are in fear for their lives, with good reason. I'm going to tell you what each of these men said, and if we can reach an agreement, I'll set up meetings. I think you'll want to settle the Cordell case out of court.
Doubtful, Parisi said, but go ahead and convince me.
Will do, Yuki said. My first witness will admit under oath that he killed Aaron Ray Cordell.
Where are you going with this?
Parisi asked.
We don't contest that Cordell was murdered in jail. Why would we protect his murderer? We should charge him.
Yuki said,
This man was hired to, and I quote, put Cordell down quick in exchange for being moved to a different penal facility.
Who promised him that?
Parisi asked.
Yuki said, A police officer did that, Len.
Why?
Jacoby asked.
Why would a cop want Cordell dead?
That brings me to witness number two, said Yuki.
Neither man at the table spoke. She had their undivided attention. She said,
The cop who commissioned the hit on Cordell is one of the three who killed the drug dealers.
Parisi said,
You're saying that a cop who participated in the murder of the dope dealers had Cordell put down to cover his tracks?
That's right, said Yuki. Witness number two was in the crack house on Turk and Dodge and can corroborate that. He saw the shooting. With protection, he'll testify that Aaron Ray Cordell didn't do it, and he may be able to identify one or more of the men who did.
Chapter 83. Judge Quirk closed the door to his chambers. He picked the Bible up from his desk and went to the seating area where several people were assembled. Yuki Castellano, Leonard Parisi, Warren Jacoby, and a jittery young man in jeans and a hoodie who sat in a side chair, jouncing his feet. The judge settled into a wing chair beside the witness and said,
Please tell us your name, young man.
Arturo Mendez.
Place your hand on this Bible, Mr. Mendez.